we know from the very first Rashi on Parshat Noach, there are two views in our tradition about how to view Noach. Whether we see the things that he does in a praiseworthy fashion or in a shameful fashion. When the floodwaters reside and the ark finally comes to a rest, when the dove which Noach sends out for the third time does not return, and when the Torah tells us explicitly, Yavashah Haaretz, that the earth had dried, we are then informed that Noach waited for a divine command, Tse min ha-teva, before he would leave the ark. This seems to be perplexing. Why did Noach need a command to leave the ark? One would have expected that he would flee from that ark, from that Dr. Doolittle-ian environs, from that zoo, to freedom. If the flood was now over, then surely there was no reason to sit in the ark when Noach had no need to do so. Various answers can be conceived. Clearly Noach must have been terrified to see what he would find out there. Imagine yourselves the Havdil as one of the liberators of the Nazi death camps, where there were bodies everywhere, one piled upon the other. Imagine experiencing an earthquake and then looking outside to see the damage that was done. With the graves of all mankind scattered upon the earth, we might understand why Noah was reluctant to leave the ark. Or one might conceive of a different answer. Witnessing the destruction of the entire world, the world evil and incorrigible, Noach may have had his reservations about the wisdom of beginning civilization anew. Why start it all up again? Better to stay in the ark and leave the earth to the Ribbono Shel Olam. These answers are attractive, but I wish for now to consider the insight of a Medrash. The Medrash will be explained in one moment by a view I saw in Iturei Torah on pages 72 to 73. According to the Medrash, immediately following the grounding of the ark, the sons of Noach, made ready for exit. Netze mikan, they demanded. Let us leave from here. Let us get out of here. To which Noach replied, Chas v'shalom. Birshut HaKadosh Baruch Hu nichnasnu, ubirshut anu yotzeim. It was under God's guidance that we entered the ark, and it will be under His guidance that we will leave the ark. What is the meaning of this Medrash? What were Noach and his sons really arguing about? Noach's children understood. They understood well why Noach had built the ark, why he had brought in the animals, and why he had dwelled in it. Because his life was in danger. In such a situation, he had to rely on God. But now that the danger had passed, and life was back to normal, there was no need to await divine guidance. It was clear that they could now survive on their own. To Noach, however, his sons were confused. Every aspect of life, not just the rough times, but every aspect requires a God-given initiative. Even what seems so obvious a course of action as to leave the ark could not be done, according to Noach, without divine sanction. And this dispute between Noach and his sons continues into contemporary times. It is a dispute which divides orthodoxy from non-orthodoxy, and a genuine Torah perspective from that which is not. The view of the sons of Noach was that one's involvement in God's commandments is dependent upon crisis situations, or if I may expand that notion a bit, upon critical life situations and events, and upon rites of passage. In 1966, Richard Rubinstein, a radical Jewish theologian, said as follows, Judaism is the way in which we share the decisive times and crises of life through the traditions of our inherited community. Over 20 years later, in 1987, Harold Schulweis, a major non-Orthodox thinker, said the following: "Most American Jews encounter halacha in rites of passage, in birth and in grief, in adolescence and bar bat mitzvah, in marriage and the wedding, in divorce and the get, in death and the funeral." He is right, I believe. That is how most Jews in America see it. The mitzvot of the Torah and the halachic system are necessary for the significant moments of life, but not for the everyday mundane experiences. This was the approach of the sons of Noach. Noach's view, which is our view, is that the Torah is a Torah Chaim, an Eitz Chaim. It is a Torah of life in all its hues, from the most momentous occasions in life to the most trivial. It encompasses everything. It elevates and sanctifies everything. All is to be instructed by divine command. A few years ago, I attended a lecture of a popular spokesman for Judaism, non-Orthodox, and engaged him in a discussion that the audience found most productive and provocative. According to Jewish law, there is a specific manner in which one is to tie his shoes. Since the Torah gives precedence to the right over the left, one must first put on his right shoe and then his left shoe. However, since in regard to tying, the Torah gives precedence to the left, as it's commanded that tefillin be tied on the left arm, one then ties the left shoe and only afterwards the right one. When the speaker to whom I was listening characterized the halacha of shoe tying as an example of the unfortunate element in halacha, so trivial, so meaningless, I argued exactly the opposite, that the fact that there is even a way in which a Jew must tie his shoe, far from being trite, is in fact of the essence of Judaism. And it is so because the Torah is a guide for all of life, not just the sublime moments, not just the tragic moments, but for every facet and detail of the human experience, just as Noach's view put forth. Unfortunately, there are many who subscribe to the philosophy of B'nai Noach. There are those for whom the totality of Judaism consists of Yahrzeit, Yizkor, or Kaddish. And I don't mean to belittle any of these. As Rabbi Joseph Lookstein once famously stated, many have come to Jewish life through the portals of death. But these are not the central concepts of Judaism. The Judaism to which we must dedicate our lives is not Yahrzeit Judaism, is not Yizkor Judaism, not Kaddish Judaism. What Judaism? I would say shoestring Judaism. That's right, shoestring Judaism, that attempts to make sacred every moment and every motion of our existence, envisioned already long ago by the ancient tzaddik Noach. It is said that a young student once traveled to Mezrich to learn from the famous Magid of Mezrich, a legendary figure of European Jewry. Upon his return from the Magid, the student was asked to share some of the great secrets he had learned, some of the brilliant ideas that he had acquired. "Tell us," demanded his peers, "what did you learn from the great Magid?" The student answered, "From the Magid, I learned to tie my shoes." The ideas we have just put forth establish Noach as indeed that righteous individual that we should praise, in the way that he responded after the flood, before he left the ark. But now, an opposing view, as there always seems to be with Noach. Recently, I acquired a new work by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks entitled Covenant and Conversation. And he does not praise Noah as I did, for recognizing that everything is to be done through the guidance of Hashem. Instead, Rabbi Sacks criticizes Noach for his actions, and he finds in the Medrash Tanhuma something I did not find. I have a Medrash Tanhuma of a different edition than the one that he quotes. He notes that according to the Tanhuma, the Ribbono Shel Olam speaks as if he is not happy with Noach, but exasperated. You ask for a command to leave the ark. Noach, fine, leave the ark. It's almost as if he's saying. He's almost saying, Noach, come on, you do not need a command to go out and rebuild the world. It should be obvious to you. In fact, in this Tanhuma's version, it adds, says Rabbi Sacks, that Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eli said that if he would have been in the ark at the time and the flood would have stopped, he would have broken down the door to take himself out. Now maybe he was praising Noach's patience, how he continued to stay in with his animals and the smell and so on. But Rabbi Sacks understands it to mean that Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eli was criticizing Noach. He would not have waited for a command before he left. He would have broke down the door to go out and start rebuilding the world. Throughout the ordeal of the building of the ark, we are told again and again of Noach's character of obedience, points out Rabbi Sacks. In fact, we have no record in the text that Noach ever utters a word, not a word. All we are told four times in chapter 6, verse 22, in chapter 7, verses 5, 7, and 16, is that Noach does everything exactly as God has commanded him to do. But enough already, Noach, the Medrash suggests, according to Rabbi Sacks. Some may see this as a little controversial, perhaps. But to Rabbi Sacks, obedience is not enough. And he adds very insightfully that we see in what happens to Noach after the flood that he gets drunk and takes off his clothing, and that absolute obedience, therefore, is not enough not only to save the world, but it's not enough to even save yourself. Noach the Tzaddik, who did not make an effort to save anyone else but himself, now becomes a person who himself needs saving, who has fallen from grace, who is not able perhaps to continue to live a life of dignity as he realizes that merely obeying should not have been sufficient for someone of his stature. Rabbi Sacks does not say so, but it is clear to me, if we go with his viewpoint, why Noach would have been so devoted to the trait of obedience. Because how did the first human beings fall in Gan Eden? By not obeying the divine command. And so Noach goes to the other extreme, elevating obedience to the highest possible level, never questioning God's plans in response to the sin of the first human beings. But as we will soon learn, there is some type of a middle ground. Avram Avinu does not submit to blind obedience in his relationship with Hashem. He questions God's plan to destroy the cities of Sodom. And yet, on the other hand, he does not question the command to offer Yitzchak as a sacrifice. There he is, fully and absolutely obedient. Sometimes he questions. Sometimes he does not. But obedience alone is not his only concern. There is a time to question. In the theme of Nasa v'Nishma, I will do it, but I want to hear more. This is the approach of Avram Avinu, not Noach, who is satisfied with obeying, obeying, and obeying. One would think, concludes Rabbi Sacks, that for any religion, obedience would be the highest value of the faith. But it is not so in Judaism. Greater than obedience, he claims, is taking responsibility. We have pointed out in the past that the name Noach, some say, comes from the word meaning at rest, to be passive. The word for a Jew will be Israel, one who struggles, even with great powers. The act of struggling suggests the antithesis of being passive. When one struggles, one is always moving, doing battle, engaging. In fact, Chazal tell us, Lefum Sara Agara, according to the struggle, is the reward. Struggle is part of the process of personal and universal redemption. And Noach, it appears, had no struggles. A tzaddik tamim he may have been, an absolute tzaddik, at least at the outset. But we are well aware that our tradition identifies the Baal Tshuva, the person who has struggled with his inclinations, as greater than the tzaddik, who may not encounter the same level of struggle. To struggle is something human. It is to be expected. But it was absent from Noach. He did not struggle with God's decree. He did not struggle with the destruction of the world. And after it was destroyed, he patiently waited for God's instructions. You do not wait around for divine sanction to rebuild a lost world, says Rabbi Sacks. After the Holocaust, the Jewish people had to take responsibility. They could no longer wait for what was previously believed to be the divine plan, that the Mashiach would come and redeem our world as we sat obedient and waited. A devastated world requires a courageous response, and a response that indicates a balance in the divine and human longing for redemption. According to this view, Noah was at fault for not responding properly at the end of the flood and immediately trying to rebuild his world. So the machlokas of how to view Noach begins at the outset of the parsha when he is described before entering the ark, and that machloket as we presented it continues after the flood is over as Noach prepares to leave the ark. It's a machloket that will continue in the attempt by all generations to understand that unique figure, the only one called Tzaddik Tamim and called it by God himself in the Torah, and yet a figure who nonetheless is controversial and comes under the critical eye of all those who read about the events that characterized his life.